everyone. I'm Maria Garcia. I'm an arts and culture reporter for WBUR, Boston's NPR News, and I'm so excited to host this panel with some incredible authors. We're going to be talking about journeys today, some really profound journeys, some strange journeys, some incredibly perilous journeys. So I'm really excited to get started. But first, I want to introduce each of you. We'll start with Holly Fitzgerald, who wrote Ruthless River, Love and Survival by Raft on the Amazon's Relentless Madre de Dios. I'm going to let each of you do an introduction of your book for people out there who haven't read it in just a bit, but first I want to introduce all of you. And then we have Leland Melvin next to her, who wrote Chasing Space, An Astronaut Story of Grit, Grace, and Second Chances. And then we have Ayelet Waldman, who wrote A Really Good Day, How Microdosing Made a Mega Difference in My Mood, My Marriage, and My Life. And then finally, Andrew Forsthoffel, who wrote Walking to Listen, 4,000 Miles Across America, One Story at a Time. So it's an honor to be here with all of you. So let's start with you, Holly. Your book is about a honeymoon essentially gone awry in the jungle in South America. And not only is it an exploration of physical survival, but also of the survival of your marriage and the love between you and your husband in such a perilous time. Can you talk about the actual journey?
Sure. Well, the story really, it's a true story about us. We had decided to take a delayed honeymoon around the world, and we saved up some money, did different jobs. My husband did, he was a reporter and I was a social worker, but we weren't going to make enough that way, so he went to McDonald's and did a job as a... he heated the buns, but he burned them, so he was fired within 4 days. But anyway, so we got different jobs like that to add up, and within 9 months we had enough, we figured, to go around the world. And we had an itinerary. We ended up reading all kinds of books. We gave our parents the itinerary. We were just newlyweds, really, so we had no commitments, and that's why we decided to do it then. No house, no kids, and so we started down, and we were having a great time. We started in South America, and we were there for 5 months, and then we ended up on a DC-3 going into the jungle, and it crash-landed in the jungle, and that's really where the story starts getting worse. We ended up in a penal colony for the worst criminals in Peru, and we had to stay there a few days for another plane to come in. So there were murderers and all kinds of people, and we said, well, but there are no fences, there are no walls. I mean, they were right there with us. And the guards said, well, nobody's getting out of this jungle, so there will be no walls. There are caiman, a crocodile, South American crocodile, anacondas, all kinds of, you know, piranha. There was a river. So eventually we were able to get on another plane, but we missed our boat that we were trying to get to, and that was the last boat before the really bad part of the flood season. So some locals in that town suggested that we build a raft. That's what they did. And so, being in our 20s,
the Pink Palace.
Yes, the Pink Palace. And in our 20s, the Pink Palace was beautiful, our very first home that we owned. And it was a very small raft, about the size of a Toyota car. And we had a lot of confidence, and we had a license that had been stamped many times by the harbor master. So we were off. And everything was great. We were going 500 miles to our destination towards the Amazon River. We were on this tributary. And everything was great, and then a big storm came up. We only had one more day to get to our destination. And then that's really when things really turned worse, because all the food went off overboard. Well, most of it. We had a little bit of sugar couple things. So for 26 days, we were trapped in a dead end.
You were literally starving.
Yes, we were starving. And so the story is really about how we tried to get out in every way possible that we could think. And so here we were, newly married, but yet we were really working together, trying to, neither one of us knew anything. So so we both had put our heads together and tried swimming with those piranha, tried everything, sleeping in trees, all that stuff. So
A lot to unpack there that we're going to get to. But I want to get to Leland, Chasing Space. This story is your journey from a young man. You even go into your childhood in Lynchburg, Virginia, and then through college to the NFL with the Detroit Lions, a little bit with the Dallas Cowboys, then to NASA, and sort of like how you navigated that both internally and externally throughout the way.
I want to first say, she was in the scariest environment imaginable. Space is
compared
to what you were doing, okay? I grew up in this small town, Lynchburg, Virginia, and I never in my wildest dreams imagined playing in the NFL or going to space. And in 1969, when Neil and Buzz were walking on the moon, and you know, I was watching that grainy black and white television, you know, after that, all the kids were like, "You want to be an astronaut?" I'm like, no. I didn't want a crew cut. I didn't look like one of those military guys.
And you described it as like the military pilot. That
right,
was like
the military
the quintessential
pilot.
NASA
exactly.
person, right?
That wasn't me. But 5 blocks down the street from where I lived, on Pierce Street in Lynchburg, was where Dr. Whirlwind Johnson, who was the first black doctor who integrated the hospital that I was born in, and he was training Arthur Ashe and Althea Gibson to play tennis. And so my dad always talked about, you know, how great Arthur Ashe was as a person, his character, his discipline on the court, his athleticism, his brilliance. And so he just kept talking about it. And I said, I want to be Arthur Ashe. I'm not going to be an astronaut. I'm going to be Arthur Ashe. And so I started taking tennis lessons and I'd doing all these things. And then you know, we moved from Pierce Street to Hilltop Drive, and I started playing football and doing some other things, and ended up dropping a touchdown pass in the end zone, my homecoming game. All my friends are there. They're back from college. My mom and dad, my family, they're all there, and I'm in the end zone. I drop this pass, and I go to the sideline, and my coach, Jimmy Green, you're Jimmy, he says, he grabs me by the face mask. He says, Leland, I believe in you. Get back in there and catch the ball. Run the same play. I'm like, but coach, I suck. I'm embarrassed. You know, I wanted to just give up. I was actually, little tears were in my eyes. And I went back out there, and the quarterback says, I'm not throwing the ball back to you. You just dropped my touchdown pass in the end zone. And so we run the play again. This time I can reach Spalding on the side of the ball as it's coming in. And we catch the ball. We win the game. Unbeknownst to me, there was a college scout from the University of Richmond there to see if I could play for the Spiders. And he walked out of the stadium when I dropped the first pass. He heard the crowd screaming the second time. And he saw me in the end zone, like, doing a little dance. You know? He said, if he can recover from such a horrific failure and catch the ball the second time, maybe he can play for us. So that one catch resulted in a $180,000 scholarship. And I realized at that point that, you know, if you have grit, perseverance, you know, you get these second chances, you don't give up, good things can happen. And my mother always read to me The Little Engine That Could, I Think I Can, and Curious George, which always made me curious and look up at the night sky, even though I didn't want to be an astronaut. And it was just all of these sequence of things. I was abused as a child sexually. I had my freshman year in college, I was kicked out of school for allegedly cheating. And my professor, who was my chemistry professor, he said, Leland, come talk to me. I don't care what happened. You couldn't have cheated on my tests because my tests are really hard and you did well. I'm going to get you back in school. And you're going to have to work for me as a research assistant for the next 4 years. So I'm playing football at Richmond. I'm missing most of the hard practices because I'm in chemistry lab with my professor. And long story short, I get drafted to the Lions, I pull a hamstring, I start grad school at UVA in materials science engineering, and then I go work for NASA, And a friend says, you'd be a great astronaut. I'm like, yeah, right. You know, I'm not that military test pilot guy. And a friend of mine applies and gets in. And I say to myself, wait a minute. NASA's letting knuckleheads like that in to be astronauts? Maybe I could be one, too. So I applied the next election, and I got in. And more stories about failure. I lost my hearing in a training accident, lost all of it going down in this 5-million-gallon pool. They forgot to put this pad in my helmet, and I couldn't clear my ears, so blood's coming out of my ears, and the doctors tell me I'll never fly in space, and I just stayed the path. I kept going. People believed in me when I didn't believe in myself again, and I got a waiver to fly, and I flew 2 times. So that's chasing space.
I have to admit, there were times when I was reading your book where I might have cried a lot.
Yeah.
Not a little bit, a lot. Next we have Ayelet Waldman, who wrote A Really Good Day, How Microdosing Made a Mega Difference in My Mood, My Marriage, and My Life.
I don't even know what this trip has to do with any of those others. That's incredible. I did not fly in space or survive the Amazon or walk across the country. I just took some LSD, man.
That's a strange journey. That's a strange trip.
So A Really Good Day is about it's about an experiment I did microdosing with LSD. So LSD is a psychedelic drug, but I took very tiny doses that are sub-perceptual, so there was no tripping involved, actually. And I used that one-month experiment as a kind of structure to hang a discussion about mental illness, because I was using it as a treatment for depression, and about the war on drugs, because I was a law professor, and I created a seminar called The Legal and Social Implications of the War on Drugs. It was all about the way that we criminalize different drugs in this country and why, spoiler alert, race. And it's about sort of an alternate vision of both therapy and drug policy. And then it's also about my marriage.
It's also a very personal journey.
Yes.
I mean, you came upon LSD in a very desperate time in your life.
I was, after many, many years of treatment, I was suicidally depressed, and it was kind of like acid or death. So I decided to try it, and it worked incredibly, incredibly well. It has tremendous, as we're seeing now in the news, psychedelic drugs are non-addictive and have very few side effects and have tremendous potential in treating mental illness, including addiction, which we're in Massachusetts right now, which has an astronomical opioid addiction rate, and one of the only drugs that is effective in long-term treatment of addiction is a psychedelic drug called Ibogaine, which not only alleviates symptoms of withdrawal, but also seems to, the experience of having a mediated trip with Ibogaine seems to lead to not using, to quitting opioids in a much more expeditious fashion than anything else. Because we don't really have a good treatment that's legal yet.
Right. All right, and up next we have Andrew Forsthoffel, who wrote Walking to Listen, 4,000 Miles Across America, One Story at a Time. And you walked from Pennsylvania to California in a little under a year with a sign on your body that said Walking to Listen. You met so many kinds of people. You listened to so many kinds of people. And along the way, you were waiting for that epiphany, like that cathartic moment, and you described your journey as, you know, an initiation into adulthood. You were trying to figure out, like, who you were, and you thought this journey would reveal that to you.
Yeah, and it did. Yeah. Yeah. In ways that I never would have imagined or had the audacity to hope for, really. I graduated from college, and had all of these questions that that were demanding my full presence and attention, just the basics, you know, that we all have. Who am I? Why am I here? What am I doing here? Who are we, you know, actually, offline, you know, not in books, not in a classroom, like, who are we, boots on the ground? And who am I? Far away from anyone I know, you know, from anyone who's telling me who I am, and who am I in the aloneness, and what's there waiting to be experienced and felt. And in the people, in us, you know, who are we? So.
And you had Walt Whitman as
I had Walt Whitman as my guide. Rainier Maria Rilke and Khalil Gibran, three poets. Brought them in my, I was gonna say brought them in my little backpack, but it was a huge backpack and heavy. And I actually, I read some, but I'm remembering now a man I met in Louisiana who let me camp out underneath his RV. He owned a bar right on the swamp. And it was the day I left New Orleans, so I was devastated, you know. And it was raining. And the next day, his name was Big George, and he had a dog named Goat. And we didn't talk a whole lot, but the next morning he said, you know, really all you're doing is reading a book just with your feet. And he was right. He was right. I was reading this book, and we're all the authors, and co-creating it, and listening, really listening, and learning what it actually is to listen. And I think, I mean, the book is filled with stories and people and thoughts, but I'm most excited about what it suggests about the world that is possible, not that could be possible, but that is possible with an authentic willingness and ability to listen deeply. And not just when you're walking across America, but, you know, at all moments.
That's anomalous now to have somebody who will just sort of like listen to you and hold that space.
It's amazing how, this it sounds so unremarkable. Like when I'm talking about listening, it's like there are all these associations with obedience, you know, like listen to me, you know, or just some sort of passive reception of, to meet someone who's actually seeing you and ready to receive all of you is extraordinarily rare. And I know that because of the way people responded to me when I was willing to do that for them.
Speaking of the way sort of people responded to you, there's a sort of a common thread in each of your books about the exploration of like who you are in the world and your identity. And I know that sounds really broad, but you deal with it with such specificity in each of your books. When you start off in your journey, one of the first things you ask yourself, and we'll sort of go in this order with this question, is could I have done this with the same sort of fearlessness that I did? Were I a person of color? Were I a woman? Could I, as a woman, decide to walk across the country and knock on strangers' doors every night, asking to sleep on their front yards? Could I camp out by myself? And you sort of wrestle with that question throughout the book about, like, the safety that your body provides you. Sort of like the privilege that comes with that.
My experience over the course of the whole year was hugely influenced by the way that people perceived me. And so many of the experiences that I did have simply wouldn't have happened had I been a person of color or had I been a woman. Again, the way I know this is because many of the people who took me into their homes and fed me and even told me they loved me would then reveal some kind of bigotry or homophobia or, you know. And to me, what was hard for me about that was I had been let into their hearts, you know. So I knew that they had hearts. I knew that they were people. I couldn't just write them off as, oh, you're just a racist. You are, you're a racist, and that's not okay, but all of a sudden I can't hate you because you just told me about how you lost a son. And so what do I do with that? And I was walking in that paradox of I can't bear what I just had to listen to, what I just got to listen to. I can't bear it. And yet I can't walk away from you because I've seen that part of you that is worth relating to, that heartbrokenness that we are all subject to that makes us human. I people showed me this. So just this paradox.
Right, yeah. The nuance of humanity that really came through in your journey. Ayelet, that came through in your journey too. You know, your book is also an examination on the war on drugs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we cannot have a discussion about the war on drugs without talking about who it affects the most and who those laws were written for beginning at the end of the 19th century. And so, which is people of color. And so you talk about, you know, throughout your journey, how sometimes you had moments where you thought you were like having a heart attack in the middle of the night, thinking like, what am I doing? I'm a mother of four and I'm taking LSD. And you sort of had these like internal moments of panic, but you never really feared getting arrested or getting in trouble with the law because you knew that your education,
My color.
Your race. So, yeah, and your color. My color. I protected you.
So, you know, I came to this, you know, I was profoundly depressed. I mean, I'd gone through periods, you know, I like to say that the lithium river runs wide and swift through my family tree. I mean, I come from a family with lots of mental illness, and I had reached this breaking point, and so I made this seemingly crazy decision to try this illegal drug. But I was, you know, I had spent a lot of my career doing drug policy reform, and I was a criminal defense attorney, and I knew exactly what my risks were, and that's why I felt like I could do it. But I was always conscious of the fact that if I were a young African-American, you know, man or boy, child, woman living in another place, I wouldn't have the freedom to say, I'm going to try this drug that is really promising and really illegal, because I would have been incredibly afraid of being arrested. Now, that's not to say that I wasn't afraid. And I became a lot more afraid after November. Like, I don't know if I would have published this book if I had known that we were going to elect Donald Trump and put the most reactionary, lunatic, drug war maniac in the Attorney General's office. I mean, I think it's really important to know that Jeff Sessions isn't a normal Attorney General. He is a retrograde, unbelievably cataclysmic racist drug war warrior. And the reason that he is a drug war warrior is because he hates black people. And I think it's really important for all of us to say that out loud. So, you know, I write in the book that this is the book that that depression wrote. This is a book, in a real way, it's a book about my marriage, because when you are depressed, you are so locked in your own head that it's really hard for you to see the effect that you're having on the people who love you. And it's also really terrifying. And I think for a lot of people who are depressed who go on to commit suicide, one of the primary reasons for that is that they have a recognition of the effect they're having on the people who love them. And that guilt and shame can often be the catalyst for a suicidal act. But so it is the book that depression wrote, but it's also the book that privilege wrote, because my solution was a solution that I could turn to only because of who I am. And certainly writing about it, I could only do because of who I am. But I'm always kind of a little anxious that, you know, the feds are going to show up. Like my people at my readings are often come up to me and they're like, because one of the things I write about is that I got this mysterious package of LSD in mail and I don't have any more and I could never buy it illegally. And all these people often come up and they're like, I'm like, no, 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 no. I see you, DEA informant. Back away.
And Leland, you know, your journey also explores sort of your identity in this world. Right. And what struck me so much about your journey is that you recognize the fragility in your position. And sort of the resilience that it would take to overcome these circumstances that were just sort of stacked against you. I mean, you talk about in high school when you were a senior and you had gotten this, right. You know, full scholarship to the University of Virginia, and, you know, you're in a car with your white girlfriend, and, you
Asian
know, you guys
but
are in a
but non-black.
Non-black, I'm right. sorry. And right. you guys are just hanging out, and then this trooper comes and stops right. you and tries to convince your girlfriend to falsely accuse you of rape, which could have derailed. I mean, could have completely derailed your career.
Right.
In Moscow, you're there with NASA, and these skinheads follow you and chase you around. Right. And what struck me, sort of like the grace with which you respond to these situations, was really incredible to read.
Right. I think even before that, when I was 5 years old. I was playing in my yard, and these two boys who were neighbors coaxed me into their garage and sexually assaulted me. And the first thing that I thought of was, if I tell my father would kill them. And I didn't want to lose my father. So I was trying to protect our family to keep my father in the family, because if he had done anything to those boys, he would have been in prison. I know that. And I know that he would have been so filled with anger that his son had been violated like that, that he would have been gone. And then it was another time, I think it was in middle school, I was a janitor cleaning the toilets in this bank, and the bank president walks in, and I speak to him and I say, "How you doing, sir?" And he looks at me in a way that it's like I was translucent. He looked right through me. He never said anything. And I felt, you know, even smaller then. I said that, you know, what does this mean for me in this society, in this town of Lynchburg, Virginia? Who am I? What is my identity? You know, I had this violation happen, but I couldn't say anything because I would have been without a father. And I had too many friends without fathers. And then that moment in the car with my girlfriend, the state trooper, he took her out and put her in the car,
in his trooper car,
and I was watching, and he was just having this very civil conversation, like, you know, and I could tell he was trying to convince her of something, but I couldn't hear, and, you know, we were in love, and she was going to UVA, I was going to Richmond, and, you know, it was like an hour away, and I just thought, what if she had just cratered, and said, you know, because her parents were Asian, and she didn't want, you know. They didn't really know about our relationship that much, because they were, I'm not gonna say they were racist, but they didn't like our relationship. She wanted her to be with an Asian boy. And so I thought for a moment that when he said, "We're gonna tell your parents you're going to jail," that she would have possibly cratered and had me going to prison.
Going to make your parents pick you up
right,
from jail, sort of
right,
implying
right.
that your parents are going to find out
your
about this
relationship find out,
if you don't accuse him.
Right. So when she wouldn't fall for that, and then he brought me to the car, and he was joking, he started joking around, like, "Well, let this be your graduation present, you know, and you guys get out of here." And I had this little smirk on his face, and just kind of ugly. But that showed me right there when, you know, there's a very tenuous line of being on one side or the other, and, you know, again, $180,000 scholarship to college. If she had just said one little thing, I would have been in prison. And once you're in the system, you know,
that's it.
You know, you're really hard to get out. And then moments of driving while black, getting pulled over. I'm assuming the 10-2 position, because I know that if I move my hands too fast, you know, Orlando Castile or some of these other cases where people have been killed because of the color of their skin. And so, the other thing at Richmond when I was accused of cheating, I was tutoring a senior. I was a freshman in chemistry. He was in football chemistry, okay? So how ironic, right? The football player tutoring the guy who needs to graduate from football chemistry.
And football chemistry, to be clear, is sort of the
non-major
right,
chemistry.
The most basic chemistry,
right. And so he needs a B to get a C to graduate. And I tutored him for 2 weeks, and we're in his room celebrating, and his girlfriend walks in. And she's a chemistry major, but in another section of the same professor I have. And she starts mentioning some things that are on the test. And I'm like, "Oh, okay, that's cool." And the next thing I know, I take the final, I go home for Christmas break, and I have an X for my grade. And I come back, and I get called down to the honor council. I'm thinking, well, I'm a freshman, but they want me to be on the honor council now. And I'm just, oh, okay. Oh, no. And I walk into this building, and these people are looking at me like, you know, you cheated, didn't you? And I was instantly taken to court. The jury was all people that didn't look like me. And the next thing I knew, I was sitting on the steps crying, about to get picked up by my dad to go home from
college. You were expelled.
A freshman. I was expelled. I was a freshman. Mm. And so just, yeah, color has a way of switching things up, or just that perception. And even
were you ever exonerated, or did they just?
No, my professor intervened and got me back in. That's why I had to do research for him for the next 4 years. But lots of things like that throughout my journey. Just here's a perfect example. I was walking into a room to give a talk to kids. It was an elementary school. And I walk in, and I have my business clothes, just my regular clothes on, my flight suit's in the bag, and I ask the principal, where's the bathroom? I don't have time to tell you because I'm waiting for astronaut Leland Melvin. And I'm like, really? So I find the bathroom, I put my flight suit on, and I come back. Oh, astronaut Melvin! Oh. Again, you know, you're not seen as a human being sometimes until you're in the right suit, or in the right skin, or in the right something. So it's been a lot of those things that have happened just because of, you know. But well, grace is important. My mother's name is Grace, and she's taught me to always be respectful, graceful, and that if you keep trying, you keep going, things will usually work out.
Speaking of keep going, keep trying. when you were in the Pink Palace, and it's called the Pink Palace, your raft, because you had a pink tent over it. One of the most striking scenes in your book that sort of grabs you just from the beginning is when you and your husband are essentially emaciated. You're laying down in this raft to sort of save energy, and there are hundreds of bees just knocking at your tent. That if you would open it just a little bit, would just swarm in, and sting you. I mean, hundreds of bees. And can you talk a little bit about sort of like the resilience of that month?
Well, I guess it is the keep on trying, trying to persevere, trying to find inside, deep down, what is going to keep us going through things like that. And that's when you start looking for the meaning to keep going, right, which I suppose all of us have written about in one way or another, the journey. It was the hope that we just kept finding. Of course, it did help that the two of us were there together. Mm. And our love, I think we were really honeymooners still. So we just kept on helping each other, and if one was down, the other would try something. Sometimes we'd be looking for, we didn't know what would be poisonous or what was safe to eat. We were just trying to fish, and we weren't having any luck with anything. Everything was pretty much, everything we tried, we failed. So I think that keep on trying type of thing is when you really have to dig down and say, what is the point? Why are we here? Mm-hmm. And finally, I had something that I thought would be important. Well, everybody has different things probably, but that helped to keep the hope going and the perseverance. I think you really, if you have those, you just keep hoping that maybe a plane will come by or somebody will hear you. Uh-huh. And we were out so far that there was nobody. It was hundreds of miles of water, flooded land. So the water was way up the trees, so there was no way of walking out. It was maybe 20 feet up when it's the flooded season. So we were trapped in this dead end, and the raft was so huge in terms of raft only goes one way down. So we did different things. We built a little raft and tried that. That didn't work. So the trying, it just, we just decided we would just try until we died, and then we made it. So, but the meaning it keeps you going. When you find each person finds it when they're going deep down, what they want to live for.
Well, we have a packed house, so I want to make sure we get to audience questions about 20 minutes before we end. So we have about 6 minutes until then. I want to ask you one last question, and if we can just have more expeditious answers so that we can allow time for the audience to ask questions. But Holly, we'll start with you. Your books are about journeys, but writing a book in itself is a journey. I mean, that is sort of a separate journey. And writing by nature is a position of vulnerability. You know, to look within yourself, to examine the world around you, to recall things that are painful, to be honest, to put yourself out there, to risk the judgment of others. Writing by nature is a position of vulnerability. So I wonder if you could just tell me how your actual journey in the jungle and how the journey of writing the book differed or paralleled.
Well, the journey in the jungle, of course, was a very physical thing at first, you know, until we really got weak. But we were vulnerable in terms of animals and the fish and the creatures in the water and in the trees, the jaguars. So we're vulnerable in that way.
Jaguars.
No big deal.
Jaguars.
The jaguars.
The ocelots, the roars. So we were feeling pretty tiny there. But the vulnerability in terms of the writing, I had a journal that I'd kept all the time, and I guess if you're going to write a book, you've just got to be out there. Of course, you're not facing your friends, and I found that was different in a way, because when Fitz and I told our friends when we came home and family, we really protected really more, made it sound a little funnier than it was. whatever could be funny, but... in the book, it's painful, right? You got to really get down to it. And, but that helped in a way. I think it was kind of a catharsis of really facing it for the first time, going through how scary it was. And also, in writing a book, it's a journey of endurance also, of persevering. I can't just write half a book. You know, what's that? I can't just take half a journey in the jungle or I won't make it. So there's that parallel.
And Leland, how was it for you sort of untangling all these feelings to write this book?
I think the biggest sticking point for me was to share the abuse piece, because I'd never told anyone about it. Mm-hmm. And my father, I moved home from D.C. to Lynchburg, and I wrote the book about a year later. My father had passed, so my mother has some dementia, so I felt, you know, hopefully if she hears something about it, she'll kind of forget about it. And but I didn't want to hurt them, because that would have just destroyed them. But at the same time, it's a power that you have for helping other people who have gone through that and help them heal by hearing your story and overcoming it and being able to make it to space. I mean, not getting out of the jungle or anything, but you know, making it to space. And so if he can do that after that kind of thing that happened to him, maybe I can do it, or maybe she can do it. So that was the empowering piece, but I didn't want to hurt my parents. Mm-hmm. You know.
Mm-hmm. So. And how did writing, the journey for writing a book?
Well, I had a very similar experience to the jaguar threat. I once ran out of P.G. Tibbs tea when I was working. And it really was overwhelming. Like, could I persevere?
It's a vulnerable
with, like,
position,
a,
for sure.
An Earl Grey instead, through that whole day of really focusing. You know, I'm a writer. This is what I do for a living. You get up in the morning, you do your work. It is. If you're a writer and you sit around waiting for the muse to strike, then you are someone who wants to write a book. So the most important, as I always tell kids when I'm teaching writing, the most important part of your body, if you're a writer, is not your head and it's not your hands, it's your ass, because you got to get that ass in the chair, and then the words will come.
Nice.
Amen.
And Andrew?
Writing the book for me was, I spent this year on the road, and I think I was just like, I was listening. I was in this state of receptivity, and just it was all coming through me and passing through. And Whitman has this line that was sort of guiding me of you shall listen to all sides and then filter them from yourself. And the book was that for me. Of just like, all right, there's all these stories, all these thoughts and opinions, and now where, what sticks, what lands, and what connects.
Yeah.
And writing was that for me. Helped me understand.
Wow. Okay, great. So we're going to open it up right on time to audience questions. We have a microphone here in this middle aisle. So if you have a question, if you want to just come up to the microphone and line up. That was quick.
You talked about your abuse, and you do lots of psychological.
I'm sorry, can you just get a little bit closer to the
sorry.
Mic? Yes.
You talked about your abuse. You have lots of psychological tests that you take to become an astronaut. How did you navigate that? You know, with them, how is that accepted?
That question actually never came up in the testing. I mean, they ask you, do you abuse small animals? Do you kick babies? Do you know, they have some of those questions, but, and they watched your face to see how you react to it, but that never came up. Yeah, and I never brought it up. So.
Hi, thank you all. I'm really enjoying this session. I have to apologize because I've only read Ayelet's book, but I will be reading the other three of you, believe me. But with Ayelet, a couple of the things that really struck me about your book was, first of all, the honesty and the personal honesty to admit things going on inside you and just be public. And then the other part was your sense of humor. There was just, I just felt like you would be talking about some very sort of serious things, and then there'd be a little footnote with like this really humorous comment. And so I'm just wondering if you can just talk about that, about humor and how you use it.
You know, I think it has, honestly, I think a lot has to do with being Jewish. I mean, that is my people's stock in trade, right? I mean, I keep thinking of this incident that happened, not to me, but to my husband. He was doing an event, and there was a much older Jewish writer, and someone asked the two of them, my husband is also a writer, he wrote this book called The Amazing Adventures of Keller and Clay, which won the Pulitzer Prize, really good, you should go get it.
Whatever.
No big deal.
Anyways, they're standing together, and the older Jewish writer, just as the photographer was snapping the picture, whispered in his ear, don't think about Auschwitz. And Michael burst out laughing. And after the photograph is the two of them just like in gales of laughter. And the older Jewish writer said, only the Jews laugh. So he says so I imagine this like series of photographs of like two Jewish writers laughing hysterically and then one Jewish writer laughing and like a non-Jewish writer going.
I had noticed that also. It was a very sort of self-deprecating sense of humor and definitely connected with that. So thank you.
So Leland, as a lifelong dog lover, I think I just have to ask you about the photo and like the circumstances that prompted that and sort of the whole story behind it and what the reception has been. It's the photo on the cover of his book.
So I had these two rescue dogs that when I got assigned to my first mission, they tell you that you can bring your family in to take a picture. And my two-legged family's in Virginia, my four-legged family's in Houston. So I concocted this way to get them in, because dogs are not allowed into NASA, so I get this van, my neighbor's holding them back in the back, I've got the stereo turned all the way up, I gun it past the guard shack, just flash my badge, and I gun, you know, run past it, get to the photo lab, we go up the back stairs, and I have like 100 milk bones. So they're sitting there, happy as can be, eating, chewing. I'm putting on the pumpkin suit. And as I walk out to sit down, they both see me, and they just start running over to me. And I see this whole thing playing out. I'm like, start shooting, hold down the shutter, you know? And I sit down, and Jake's in my ear, and Scout's like, what are you doing, you know? And so that picture came out, and
so sweet.
It was one of these moments where it's gone viral like so many times that my editor and the marketing department said, we know the cover of your book. but it also brings so many people joy when they see the picture, because if you look down at the bottom, we're all holding hands.
Well,
paws and hands. And
yeah.
And you know, that was Team Melvin, get the space. You know? So that's the story behind Jake, Scout, and Leland. Here we go, from the cheap seats.
Hi there. Memoir is one of my favorite genres. I love to see people overcome adversity, do things that are beyond what we expect of ourselves, and succeed. What intrigues me especially is your voyage with LSD. I think this mom takes pot. I live in New Hampshire, it's legal and everything. I have six kids. I take micro doses, and I wouldn't be able to stand here today if I didn't take it because of chronic pain. But it's difficult. It's difficult when you're on a journey that people have strong opinions about, Jeff Sessions being one of them. But so that sort of, you know, that intrigues me. I mean, you've all sort of been on journeys that people, like you in the river, you know, if you were a good girl, you wouldn't have gone on such a crazy trip in the first place. You would have stayed home and made cookies, or you know, you know, in NASA, you know, what are you thinking? You know, shooting for the stars. You know, LSD, that's just crazy. And your walk, you know, I have a son who takes pot with me, and he and I have walked the length of New Hampshire, and it's amazing. Boots on the ground, it's amazing. So I don't really have a question. I just want to say that I'm just tremendously in awe of all of you. That's fantastic work.
Thank you for your courage.
Thank you. You know, it's so interesting because there is this feeling, you know, we all have these voices that silence us. And when I do events, I often have people who will come and talk about their experience with psychedelics. And people I'll say, like, how many people in the room have used psychedelic drugs? How many of you have used marijuana? And people are very open and confident. But but at every event, there are people who come up to me and ask for a private moment, and they confess with great shame that they have depression, they have mental illness. Right. And it breaks my heart that we live in a society where we can, I'm glad we can freely say that we smoke weed or whatever, you know, and that we use whatever that is, that we can feel confident saying that. But it breaks my heart that we have so much shame around the issue of mental illness and depression, that feels to all of us. And that was the hardest thing for me. To come out of the closet about using psychedelics was nothing. To come out of the closet and say that I have a mental illness, that I suffer, that I've made my family suffer, that was the really challenging part.
And that you had exhausted all of the, like, conventional medical pathways.
Yeah, well, so many of us do. If you take SSRIs or mood stabilizers, anybody who's taken them, it's a very rare person who tries one and stays on it. I mean, everybody, you know, you go on one, it stops working. I often think, like, if your doctor came up and said, I have this drug, it's designed to make you fat and have you lose interest in sex, and for some people it makes them a little bit happier, that would be a more accurate description of Prozac than,
wow.
But it is heartbreaking to me that we have so much shame around this, and I think those of us who have the opportunity to be public about our mental health challenges, we do the whole world a favor by being public and taking a stand.
The same thing with sexual violence.
Absolutely.
I mean, especially for men. I posted this. I was on your station with Robin Young talking about this incident that happened to me, and so many men and boys have emailed me or messaged me on Facebook talking about thank you, thank you, thank you, and women too. And with all the other things that are going on in the news right now with Weinstein and Bill Cosby and all these people, you know, we have to make sure that we allow people to know that, hey, these things happen, but you don't have to live with shame. You can keep going. And
it's the perpetrators who should be shamed. It's the Bill O'Reillys.
Right. Yeah.
Well, so Andrew and others, but Andrew particularly, the country seems so divided. We're in such a bubble here. You walked, I guess, at a time that was a little before everybody was so aware of that. But I wonder if you saw it coming, because obviously you walked through the bubble. Now, maybe you didn't talk to people about politics, but you listened to them, and you must have been aware of what they were thinking, what they were afraid of. I wonder if you saw it coming.
What I experienced was the division that was already there. You know, as a white man, I didn't have to experience that so closely and intimately, you know. And as a cisgendered person, as a male, I was walking with a lot of privileged obliviousness, you know, and beginning to go through the country, I began to experience what people who don't necessarily look like me are perhaps experiencing very intimately and closely every day. So it was already here. And I think what's happening now is, those of us who have been sleeping or anesthetized are waking up to the omnipresent pain, you know, the pain from which we all come as Americans, and also as humans. You know, just the pain involved with being alive. And right now, I think the pain that you're speaking to, the pain in the political sphere and these divisions and hatreds and, I was hearing that. And as I said before, I mean, the interesting challenge for me and I think for all of us is the question of, what do we do? What do you do? What do I do with this person who I find myself disagreeing with, whose opinions I find abhorrent and even dangerous? What do I do with them? What is the nature of my relationship to them? And am I responding to them with the very same energy that I find abrasive and abhorrent? I mean, there's something really interesting there. You know, the hatred that I perceive in you, does that bring out hatred in me? And if so, how can I say that I'm part of any kind of healing?
And just to be clear, you walked in 2011.
This was in 2011, yeah. And it was from Pennsylvania down to New Orleans and then to California. So about 15 states through the Deep South, through the Southwest and the West. And and I don't have an answer for it. I mean, my experience with some of those people, I remember sitting with people and listening to someone who's, I mean, there's one woman in particular I remember who took me to Ruby Tuesdays or something, you know, with her husband, put me up, showed me her stories, and the next day as I'm getting ready to leave, she says, you know, you probably shouldn't walk through the next town, Tuskegee, because all the whites left and the help stayed, and the southern black is a whole different animal than the northern black. Wow. You know, what do you do with that? And I didn't know what to do. And one thing I was encountering on the road was the voices that silenced me. You know, why couldn't I respond? Why didn't I say something? What did I do then? Nothing. And I came to realize that what did Dr. Martin Luther King call it? He said, talked about the appalling silence of the good people being as destructive as the violence perpetrated by the bad people. And I don't actually know that there is such a thing as good people and bad people. You know, I think there are people. And I didn't know what to do with those people who I before might have called bad, before I got to hear who they were and saw that kernel in them that was worth relating to, that was not deserving of extinction and annihilation. And I talked to my friend about it, and I said, I told the story. I didn't know what to say. I said nothing. I spent the whole morning walking in rage and anger and sadness and confusion, not just at what she said and believes and her perspective, but at my inability to do anything or even ask a question. What would you have done? And she, this is Rhea Trivedi, my friend, and she said, you can try asking them why. Why do you believe that? And then get curious about, you know, can you listen to this person without attacking them and find out what's underneath these beliefs? What caused these beliefs? So who are you? Why have you come to believe this? What is it like to walk through the world in this way? You know, and so what I was learning how to do and still am is how to be in relationship with someone in that way, in a sort of non-reciprocal way. Because if I'm reciprocating the very disease that I object to, I am diseased too and contributing to it. And so it's work. And it's already like here.
Hard work.
Yeah. Filled with failure. Yeah. And tiny successes.
Great answer.
Mm-hmm. Thank you to each of you. They're really terrific stories, and to the wonderful moderation. Andrew, this is sort of a bare bones question. Did you actually wear a sign that said walking to listen? How did you get people to talk to you? Did you just ask, can I go sit in your yard, or can I camp in your yard, or?
Yeah. I remember when I left home, I was terrified that nobody would trust me. And they would see, I did wear a sign. And
okay,
I was afraid they would see the sign and be like, who is this crazy guy on the side of the road listening? What do you listen? What do you want? What do you? And I remember role playing with my mother, actually. You know, I was like, you know, Andrew on the road with a backpack. And she was like, XYZ, mean person, you know. And I would come up, hi, I'm Andrew. I'm walking to listen across America. And she'd be like, what do you mean? You know, no, you're not. What do you, you know? And so I was prepared. And once I actually got out there, I virtually never encountered that, which isn't to say I didn't encounter a lot of projections. Of course I did. We all deal with our projections of each other.
Right.
So people thought I was crazy. People thought I was lots of things. But that, what I was talking about earlier, that sincere, authentic desire to listen.
You have a very intentional gaze. And
yeah,
it's engaging.
I want to know you.
Well, you changed your question
Thank
halfway
you.
Through the journey, right?
Thank you.
Initially, you were asking people, like, what would you wish
yeah.
you would have known at my age? What are some, like, life lessons?
Yeah.
And then at one point you said, that's a little contrived. I just want to listen to what you want to tell me.
Yeah. I didn't want to try to force them or manhandle them into some version of a conversation that I wanted to have. I had the intention to learn and grow, and then where do you want to go with it? That was the way.
I see the 1 minute sign up here. I'll ask the question. It's really a curiosity question, and it's about process of writing. From somebody that is huge labor to write even short, simple things, how did you choose, what was the process for knowing what was in the book and was not between the covers? Did you just write and pick later? Did you outline in advance and kind of write to what you decided you were going to write? Did you hand it to somebody for editing later? I guess what it comes to is, where is the other part of the book that's not between the covers?
Well, I think for all my books, what you see is about the ninth draft. Writing is not writing. Writing is rewriting. And when it comes to memoir, my rule is this. If you are not uncomfortable, if you are not afraid, if you are not about to reveal something too revelatory of yourself or someone else, then you are not writing close enough to the bone. And so danger is an integral part of memoir writing.
I put it all in there with the chronology, and my editor, you know, said, this is this doesn't make it tight enough, but most of the things that I wanted to put in there were in there, and especially the difficult subjects, the abuse, the potential incarceration and expulsion from school, those things.
Well, with me, I just started writing, and then so much of it I didn't end up keeping. Probably, as you say, some of it was just getting going, writing about us when we were first married, this, that, and the other. A lot about our trip that I really liked, but it didn't fit with the real story, which was when we were trapped. So we had a lot of wonderful experiences that had to go, and they were wonderful experiences about us traveling and how wonderful everybody was to us. And we were in South America, later Africa and Asia, and everybody, really mostly everybody, treated us so well. I have to say we were very fortunate, and that's why we kept going and why we went 5 months in South America when we thought we'd do a year, the whole world. But everybody would ask us, come to our ranch or come down to visit us on the beach. And we'd do it because why not? We had the time. But when I think about it at home, would I just say to somebody, well, come on home and stay with us for a week? We just meet somebody in the market, and they would be so friendly. And one time, actually, when we were in Africa, we were just trapped in this park. It was dusk, and there was no room for us in this van, the last van out. And there was a hotel, but it was very, very fancy. And so this very nice man who was a cook there let us sleep on his floor, because we tried to go out and these baboons came all around us. and they are big.
Jaguars, baboons.
That's a great image. They have big, huge teeth.
Yeah.
And they were surrounding us, and we said, this isn't a good idea. And we went back, and he was so nice.
Right.
So I have to say, there are a lot of nice people out there.
All right. Well, we're running out of time, or we have run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us and for our wonderful offers.